Welcome to the first episode of Midnight in Karachi, a Torah.com podcast. My name is Mavish Marad. My guest today is the exciting writer and artist Audrey Niffenegger, whose 2003 debut novel The Time Traveler's Wife was a massive success all over the world. Since then, Audrey has gone on to write another novel and a number of graphic novels and illustrated books, including The Three Incestuous Sisters and Raven Girl. Her work has been translated into 40 languages, and she also teaches at a university in Chicago, which is where she's joining me from today. Audrey, thank you so much for taking the time out and recording with me today.
Oh, it's delightful to talk to you. I'm so glad to be speaking.
So, you know, when I was looking up, you know, things you'd written and rereading things you'd written, I couldn't believe that it's been so much over a decade since Time Traveler's Wife was published, longer, obviously, since you wrote it, and yet it remains this massive phenomena. It was available, I mean, I don't know if you would ever have thought of this, but literally every little grocery store and corner store in Karachi that stocked even 6 books at that point would stock The Time Traveler's Wife. What's it been like to see it grow into so many people's imaginations over the years?
It's been really interesting because it was published in 2003 in the US, and that seems to have coincided with the beginning of a big shift somehow, both in publishing and in the internet. And so people have, I think readers have become different than they used to be. I mean, reading used to be this solitary activity, and, you know, sometimes you did it in a classroom with a professor and students, and sometimes you just did it by yourself. But the publication of the book seemed to coincide with this this movement where suddenly everybody wanted to be all sociable about reading and talk to each other all the time about reading. So it's been interesting because people were very communicative. They would write to me via email and say, "Oh, I'm on a beach. I'm reading your book. I'm in Costa Rica. I'm in Mexico. I'm in Saudi Arabia." It was crazy. And it seemed to also hit this nerve because America was at war, still is at war. And so suddenly people were being separated from their families. And because the book is about this couple that are constantly involuntarily being separated, that seemed to kind of resonate with a lot of military couples. And so I was getting a lot of emails from either people who were deployed or people whose spouses were just deployed, and so they were talking about this phenomenon of reading the book while they were parted from their husband or wife. So yeah, it's been really interesting. It doesn't feel like 10 years.
I think it's been more than...
I started writing it in 1997.
Wow. That is quite a while. And to have seen, I suppose, the responses over the years have changed, have they? Or have they been pretty much people reacting much in the same way? I mean, they still love it, of course.
What's funny lately is that I'm getting emails from younger people who were not really of an age to read it when it first came out. So it seems to be getting discovered by new, younger people, which is great. The responses have remained fairly steady. It seems to be a book that people give their boyfriends or girlfriends. I get a lot of men writing to me saying, "Oh, I never thought I would like a romance novel, but my girlfriend made me read it." And then there's the women who write and they say, "Well, I didn't think I'd like science fiction, but my boyfriend made me read it." So it seems to be something that binds couples together.
Yeah, and something that sort of binds the two genres together, I suppose.
To me, crossover genres is no big deal, but other people seem to find it odd.
Yeah. I personally never thought of The Time Traveler's Wife as a romance. I actually thought it was as intriguing as it was. I also thought it was immensely unsettling in a lot of ways. And yet I really appreciated, at the same time, the rules of the world you created, of the time travel itself. You know, you have the physics sorted. Sure, Henry gets shunted around time because of this particular genetic mutation, but why should his clothes? His clothes don't go. Why should they go? Makes complete sense. It always seemed so sorted to me. Were there time travel stories that you really enjoyed? Was there a favorite? Were there things that you read or watched or knew of and you thought, these are rules that I want to follow? Or did you just make them up?
mostly I just made them up. I do have favorites. Jack Finney's Time and Again is a particular favorite because in that one, the time travel is accomplished through the imagination of an artist. And he's being trained by the CIA to imagine himself into 1872 New York. And he succeeds in this because he's such an excellent imaginer. And I thought that was that's a good message. And that's a good time machine as far as I'm concerned. A lot of time travel, I think H.G. Wells, you know, he set us all on this course of imagining that time travel is something you do with a machine. And I think a lot of people have followed that idea all the way up to, say, Back to the Future, where the time machine is a DeLorean.
Right.
And, so the idea of having it be something within the time traveler, Henry is more akin to Psy, Jack Finney's time traveler, than he would be to H.G. Wells' time traveler.
Or to Marty McFly, really.
Yeah, no, as much as I adore those movies,
Yeah. And that's interesting that you say that, imagination as time travel. That's really quite perfect because it really is, I mean, you know, we've already invented time travel. We have imagination.
Yeah, I mean, to me, in my own book, the time travel is analogous to memory. Just about anything that Henry is doing physically with time travel, we do with our own memories and imaginations.
Now, over a million books, much more than a million books sold of Time Traveler's Wife alone. And it's all the more amazing when I read that how your first books were printed and bound by hand. That's what you did. You made books by hand. I can only imagine the beauty of those editions, but I'm guessing you may be glad you made the move to traditional publishing.
Well, I was always hoping to get those handmade books published commercially. I would color Xerox them and send them to publishers, and the publishers would write back and say, yeah, this is brilliant, but no thanks. But that was when color printing was really expensive.
Yeah.
And these days, the price has fallen, and the price of binding has fallen, mostly because everybody's getting things printed and bound in China and Hong Kong. But these days, those books have been published commercially, but it took having a best-selling novel to get that done. You know, my politics, I would like art to be inexpensive and democratic and be shared, and so it is nice to have the books not be so precious and exclusive.
Absolutely. Let's talk about your illustrations, though, and the process of creating a book by hand. How do you go about that now with your illustrated novels or graphic novels or novels with pictures, as it were? Is your initial process much the same as it was when the books were going to be hand-bound?
Yes. The most recent of these is Raven Girl, which I made as a collaboration with Wayne McGregor, who's a choreographer for the Royal Opera House Ballet in London. And Wayne was in love with the Aquatints in my previous books, and he wanted Aquatints. So the time frame was very short, and so I had written the story, and so I made 22 Aquatints. And my assistant and I printed just enough so that we could scan them all and send them to the publisher, and so the commercial book sort of ran ahead of the handmade version. I'm still producing the handmade version because we've just finished binding all the boxes and we're about to do a little more printing and then we'll be done. But for the purposes of having the book come out when the ballet was being performed, we needed to kind of hand it over to Abrams and Jonathan Cape, the commercial publishers.
I wonder how you decide which story in your head will be illustrated and which won't. Is there an immediate impulse to draw each story, or is it quite clear to you right away which form you should take?
Some stories are just bigger than others. My two novels, the stories are very, very complicated. And there are some things that words do better than images. It's much easier to handle time with words, time being this kind of abstract thing, and words... We have a lot of words that deal with time and describe time, and naming things and conversation. Those are all things you can do with words. It's very difficult with images. I mean, sometimes I think comics is the perfect medium because you have the words and the images together in a way that people are very accustomed to his scene. But yeah, it is a funny thing. I mean, sooner or later, I just sort of veer toward one form or the other. I don't necessarily know that all of them would have to be done the way they're being done. I mean, at the moment, I just finished last night writing a screenplay based on my second novel, Her Fearful Symmetry. And it was really interesting because in the screenplay writing, I could be much more visual because we'll be able to see, the camera will see for us. And so I think it has changed the quality of the experience without actually changing the story too much.
Will you ever be writing conventional comic books now that you bring them up?
I did one comic which was called The Night Bookmobile. I don't know if you've seen that.
It was serialized in The Guardian, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So, yeah, that was a regular comic. I am actually collaborating right now with Eddie Campbell, who is a comics artist who's also my boyfriend. And so we're taking a lot of my short stories and he's adapting them into comics, which is pretty exciting. We did a little one for The Guardian. It was published in May. They did a project where they asked a bunch of novelists and comics artists to collaborate. So we did a small thing. It was like 5 pages.
I saw that. It was really cool.
It got us going. We got kind of interested in it.
Yeah, it was really cool, actually. It made me want more.
Oh, good, because we're working on it more.
Now, you were mentioning Raven Girl a little while ago. Ballet, this whole other form of expression altogether. Raven Girl and the Royal Ballet, how did that even come about? And what was it like to see your writing completely transformed into this very physical art?
It was wonderful. I just was in love with that entire process. It originally came about because a man named David Drew, who was a longtime principal dancer for the Royal Ballet, and who, at the time that I met him, he was still working on scenarios for ballets, but he was no longer dancing because he was about 70. And David had been given Three Ancestral Sisters by his wife, June, as a birthday present, and he got excited and thought it might be a good ballet. And so he got in touch with me, and that project never happened, or it hasn't yet anyway. But David introduced me to Wayne McGregor, and Wayne said, oh, let's just start from scratch, let's do something brand new. And so we did. And boy, that's an interesting world, the world of dance. I mean, I didn't have much to do with it other than occasionally attending a performance or something, but boy, they are amazing what they can do. I mean, not just with their bodies, but just the resources they have at hand, you know, the people who make the costumes and the scenery and everything. It's just a wonderful thing.
I love that Raven Girl is about a girl who's born, you know, like a myth almost of man and bird, and she's not in the body she wants to be. It's about transformation, it's about a yearning of sorts, and to me it just kind of comes together beautifully with the time traveler's wife and Henry being, you know, trapped in this body he can't always control. And also with Her Fearful Symmetry, where, of course, you have this trapped, unhappy ghost. Now, it's one thing for me as a reader to see similar themes in your work, say, you know, years later. But do you ever, as a writer, see yourself focused on similar things and motifs?
It's funny because I always think I'm being so original, and then I get in the middle of something and I think, oh, this is just like that. When I went to art school, that was always the push. You know, you were just to always be really original and really exploring new territory and getting out there. But I'm 51 now, and I can look back and see that these preoccupations of mine form my work. I think, you know, when they say, oh, you know, what do you have to say? Well, these are the things that I have to say, and they keep coming up whether I want them to or not.
Luckily it works, right?
Yeah, mostly it works. Well, the thing is, these projects take a long time. If I wasn't obsessed with these things, it would be very hard to carry on and stick with it long enough to be finished. I mean, Time Traveler's Wife took about 5 years to write, and Symmetry took 7. Three Ancestral Sisters took 14, so, I mean, I work on things simultaneously, and they do tend to feed each other. But you've got to really be obsessed with something in order to hang in that long.
Absolutely. 14 years is an incredibly long time. How was that process?
Part of the reason it took so long was because etching is a time-consuming process. But
also because during the period I was doing it, I started when I was 22 and finished it when I was 36. Yeah. And so, you know, I was just busy. I mean, I was busy earning a living and, you know, traveling. And I think I had something like 5 different boyfriends in that period. It was just a period of instability. So everything took longer.
Now, I have to ask, because in reading up stuff about you when I was listening to this wonderful conversation you had with Neil Gaiman Bard recently, what on earth is all this about bad taxidermy, overstuffed toads and two-headed chicks? And I'm wondering how this, you know, ties into, or if it creepily does tie into at all, the Highgate Cemetery tours that you still occasionally do and have done in the past.
One of my long-running obsessions is certainly with the body, and also with death. And so things like cemeteries and taxidermy, they all tie into that. It's funny because taxidermy has recently become trendy, which just puzzles me. I mean, it is suddenly this thing, you know, people are taking taxidermy lessons. There's places in London and in Chicago where you can go for taxidermy lessons. The hipsters have taken up with it. I don't do taxidermy myself. I just collect it. And then there's that thing where you have a couple things. You have 3 or something, and then it suddenly is a collection, and people give it to you for your birthday and Christmas.
You're right, though. It has become a thing, and it's a big thing on the internet suddenly as well. Bad taxidermy. You keep seeing all these memes and all these pictures of horribly mutated creatures that someone has, I suppose, with some great earnestness tried to, you know, put some life into, and it really hasn't worked. I'm hoping that the things that you have are all, are they terrible taxidermy, or are they all beautiful things?
It's kind of a cross-section. I have some really wonderful things. The 2 best things that I have, I bought at De Rolle, which is a taxidermy shop in Paris. One of them's a badger and the other one's a porcupine. And people have given me some very lovely things. There's also some things that are a little weird. I don't always choose the taxidermy myself. People are like, here, have a crazy looking armadillo, or, you know, whatever they've decided I need. what I myself am not very partial to is animals doing anthropomorphic things, you know, animals dressed up in clothes, animals playing guitar, that kind of thing. That I just find that completely disrespectful. Part of it with me is my love of museums and libraries, and so the initial impulse was to make my house look like a smash-up between a natural history museum and a library, which it does. It's not very scientific, but it has the look.
On a recent episode of Doctor Who, The Time Traveler's Wife was sneakily featured. I was really excited to see that. I think a lot of people were. Can I just say, since I know that they have been inspired by your work before, you would be absolutely fantastic to write the show. Is it something that you'd be interested in?
Oh, yeah, I would kill to do that. That would be great. I mean, talking to Neil about his experiences doing it, I know it's a boatload of work. It's not something you undertake lightly, but yeah, I have enormous affection for that show, and I think they're so imaginative, and it would be a thrill, but, you know, it's not the sort of thing you can just start doing just because you happen to feel like it. You have to kind of sit there very demurely and wait to be asked, so, yeah, it would be neat, but, you know, there's a lot of people I can imagine doing a really good job with it, so I'm sure I'm not first in line.
I don't know who is, really, but they really should get a woman on that show. To write that show, I mean.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of feeling about that it would thrill the longtime Doctor Who fans so much. Sooner or later, you know, how can they not do it forever? You know.
Absolutely. Now, I know that when we were supposed to record earlier, a couple of months ago, I had I'd asked you to pick a playlist because we were going to do that, but, you know, now we can't. But I did want to talk to you about music because you'd sent me this fantastic playlist. It had everything from Screaming Jay Hawkins and Patti Smith to the Talking Heads and that fantastic Fiona Apple track, Hot Knife, which I absolutely adore. Do you listen to music when you write or when you draw? Where do your tastes lead you?
I don't listen to music when I'm writing, usually. The exception being, every Friday, actually in a little while, I'm going to go to this cafe. And the people who run the cafe are musicians themselves, and they have excellent taste in music. So when I'm there, there's a lot of cafe noise and interesting music. But when I'm at home, I sit very quietly and don't listen to anything. But when I'm trying to do art, it's very helpful to have music. So I think that must be evidence that totally different parts of the brain are involved in drawing and in writing. When I'm trying to use words, having somebody singing in the background isn't helpful. But in the studio, you know, making art, it actually helps take part of your brain somewhere so it doesn't get in the way.
Now, you were at Worldcon this summer. I was quite upset to not have been able to meet you there because it's my first convention. I was really excited to be able to meet a lot of people. But, you know, there were a lot of people there, and a lot of people were not met, sadly, as much as I wanted to meet them. But you were delivering the H.G. Wells lecture with English Pen, and you mentioned writing and working on two other novels currently. Will you tell us a little bit about them?
The two things that I'm doing right now... I'm writing a sequel to The Time Traveler's Wife, which the working title for it is The Other Husband. And it's about Alba de Tambo, mostly when she's a grown-up. And she's managed to get herself in a situation where she's married to two different guys. Because she herself is a time traveler, she's married to them both simultaneously and in completely different time frames. So that's one thing that I'm doing. And then the other one is a project I've been working on for ages called The Chinchilla Girl in Exile, which keeps getting put aside so I can do things like Raven Girl. So I keep setting it aside and coming back and setting it aside and coming back. I have no idea when that one will be done, but the sequel has a delivery date of 2018, so I still have some time to work on it.
I promise I wasn't going to ask, you know, no pressure.
Yeah, everybody has been sending me email lately going, when's your next book coming out? I'm like, not for a while.
Well, you know, since it's near the end of the year already, will you tell me a little bit about what your favorite books have been this year or your favorite experiences this year, whether it's TV or film or music?
I am in the middle of reading two books that I'm really liking very much. One of them is The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters, which looks like it's just going to be really amazing, just both because she's got a historian background, and so she's wonderful at doing all these period details, but also she just has such a firm hand over the storytelling. She's such a pro at kind of shaping the story in ways that are continually surprising. So I'm reading that. I'm also reading a book by Sarah Thornton, which is nonfiction. It's called 33 Artists in 3 Acts. And this one for me is quite interesting because I'm a visual artist, and so she's running around the world interviewing some very famous artists in all sorts of different countries and just sort of asking them the question, what is an artist? And it's kind of interesting because nobody seems to want to pin it down too much.
Audrey, it's been lovely speaking with you. Thank you. Under the Radar on Midnight in Karachi. Today on Under the Radar, Kurali Manikavel's Things We Found During the Autopsy. I read a strange little collection of stories a few weeks ago, my first experience with Indian writer Kurali Manikavel, whose first name, I'm told, includes a very particular sound, particular to Malayalam and Tamil Nadu, so I hope I'm getting it right. She lives in Tamil Nadu and writes the strangest, most intriguing little shorts that I've read in a while. Things We Found During the Autopsy is her most recent collection, and it's been published by Bluft, an independent publisher based in Chennai, India, who also published some great back issues of Pakistani and Indian spy novels. Things We Found During the Autopsy is Manikavel's third collection, though sadly the only one I've read. The stories are creepy, they're funny, they're sad, often really visceral. And it's really just a wonderful combination, especially with her incredibly informal and often very irreverent prose. To give you an idea about what sort of weird fiction this is, Let me tell you about the six things they found during the autopsy of this nameless girl in one of the stories. They found a Playboy magazine hidden beneath her jaw, black ants floating through her skin, angels nested beneath her heart, angels that had to be pulled out with a tweezer, Saint Sebastian tied to her spine, typhoid in her liver, and a copy of Playgirl magazine as well spread across her ribs. Here's a little something startling from the story. We knew she was the only one who would have made it with a hairless, half-aroused Playgirl man with a Siberian husky head. We imagined it happening in a series of well-lit photographs where she and the Playgirl man were naked and open-mouthed but not sweating. We contrasted the open Playgirl with the rolled and bent Playboy and decided she had been conflicted about her sexuality. We thought we could have been the awesome friends who held her hand while we dragged her out of the closet. We thought we could have convinced her it was okay to like girls, even if she didn't like any of us. That was from the story Six Things We Found During the Autopsy by Coralie Manicavel from the collection Things We Found During the Autopsy. It's really worth looking up where you can buy a copy of that. Highly recommended on Under the Radar. Next time on Midnight in Karachi. Next week, I'll be speaking to Patrick Ness, writer of The Crane Wife, A Monster Calls, and the Chaos Walking Trilogy. I'll see you then. Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on tour.com.